Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 17th, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week has it's kind of a purplish-orange background. There's a single figure in the foreground. It's President Joe Biden. He's in a tie and shirt sleeves. He's got his sleeves rolled up. He's got a big globe hoisted on his shoulder. It's almost as big as his upper body. He's bent over, straining to hold it up. And the headline is Biden's Burdens. Is his sagging popularity the result of bad breaks, muddled messaging, or weak leadership? And I believe we picked that up on the Talking Points page. We will start, as usual, with the main stories and how they were covered. Bipartisan Senate group seeks gun agreement. What happened? In the wake of the massacre of 19 students and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas, by an 18-year-old with an assault rifle, a bipartisan group of senators this week inched toward consensus on a package of measures aimed at reducing gun violence. But Republicans declared that key reforms sought by Democrats were off the table, and final passage of any legislation remained in doubt. Negotiators zeroed in on proposals to extend background checks for gun buyers under 21, provide incentives for states to establish red flag laws to prevent the sale of guns to people judged to be dangerous, and to increase funding for school security and mental health programs. Not in consideration were universal background checks, banning assault rifles or large capacity magazines, or raising the minimum age for buying a semi-automatic rifle from 18 to 21. Democrats said they were seeking any points of agreement that might draw 10 Republican votes to overcome a filibuster. I think there's a pathway to do something meaningful, said Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, who was leading the negotiations. The House was poised to pass a package of gun control measures, none of which held hope of Senate approval following wrenching testimony from gun violence victims, including an 11-year-old Uvalde survivor, Mia Cirillo, who smeared herself in a classmate's blood and played dead during the rampage. Cirillo said she is now afraid to go to school. "I don't want it to happen again," she said. And Uvalde pediatrician Roy Guerrero described seeing children at the hospital whose bodies were pulverized and decapitated, and criticized lawmakers for doing nothing to stop gun violence. "We're bleeding out," he said, "and you are not there." What the editorial said. Nearly halfway into 2022, America has already suffered 248 mass shootings of four or more people, said the Washington Post. It does not have to be this way. The common sense measures President Biden called for last week, including a ban on assault-style weapons and large-capacity magazines, would prevent at least some mass shootings, but Senate Republicans refused to even debate them. We can only hope that amid growing public outcry, some of them see there is peril in doing nothing. One shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, said the New York Daily News, but the changes the GOP will even discuss are almost meaningless. Large majorities of Americans back universal background checks, 81% in a CBS News poll, raising the age for semi-automatic rifle buyers to 21, 77%, and an assault weapons ban, 62%. But the ineffectual package under consideration in the Senate includes none of these measures. Maybe the next time we bury a classroom full of children, the politicians will start catching up to the people. What the columnist said. American gun violence has become a form of terrorism that's tearing apart the very fabric of life, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. In Philadelphia, 3 were killed and 11 wounded last weekend when a gunfight broke out on a bustling South Street. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, 3 were killed and 14 wounded outside a bar. In Phoenix, a 14-year-old girl was killed and 8 wounded in a mall parking lot. Millions of Americans want real action, but the GOP and its sick culture of gun fetishization won't allow it. Democrats are actually losing ground on guns, and it's their own fault, said Zachary Faria in the Washington Examiner. With their unwillingness to condemn Black Lives Matter rioters in 2020 and toothless district attorneys who treat criminals as victims, they fostered a lawless environment in cities. The result is surging gun sales among women, Hispanics, Blacks, and Asian Americans who've decided to take their safety into their own hands. Trying to halt America's orgy of death with the weak measures under discussion is akin to trying to stop a rhinoceros with a fly swatter, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Still, if 10 Republicans are willing to vote for any gun restrictions at all, we'll have to call it a win. But if Republicans think such carnage is acceptable, they should come out and say so, rather than insult our intelligence with talk of locking doors and arming teachers. Here's a second shorter main story. Ukraine falters in the east. What happened? Ukraine struggled to hold on to its remaining eastern territory this week as President Volodymyr Zelensky conceded that Russian forces had captured one-fifth of his country. The Kremlin said Russia had liberated 97% of Luhansk province in the eastern Donbas region and had restored roads and rail so that full-fledged traffic could flow between Russia and the territories it has occupied. Ukrainian forces did take back half of the Luhansk city of Severodonetsk, which had mostly fallen to Russia a week ago. But their control was tenuous. To boost morale, Zelensky visited the front lines and met with relocated refugees from the destroyed port of Mariupol. Russian forces, meanwhile, put those Ukrainians who were still living in Mariupol's ruins under quarantine because of a suspected cholera outbreak. They returned 210 bodies of defenders of the city's steelworks in the conflict's first swap of military dead, but they also transported to Russian territory more than 1,000 of the roughly 2,500 Ukrainian soldiers captured in Mariupol, possibly to use as bargaining chips. The Russian naval blockade of Black Sea ports has stranded 20 million tons of grain in Odessa, worsening a global food shortage. Moscow insisted that Western sanctions, not the blockade, were responsible for the crisis, and it said it would guarantee safe passage to departing ships. But Ukrainian leaders scoffed at the Russian offer and said Ukraine would only demine its coastline if another powerful nation provided escorts for the cargo ships. What the columnist said. Russian President Vladimir Putin apparently thinks he can still win the war by waiting out the West's resolve, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Some leaders, alas, have given him encouragement. French President Emmanuel Macron recently urged the West not to humiliate Russia, meaning Putin, should be rewarded for his unlawful aggression. Instead of giving Kyiv just enough aid to avoid defeat, we should boost it to victory. It needs weapons, especially rocket systems, and far more of them than the 4 units President Biden agreed to send. Putin's stubbornness offers little evidence that any kind of peace settlement is feasible, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. But the Ukraine hawks who insist on supporting Kyiv until it gets back every inch of Ukrainian soil are misguided. Divided internally and challenged abroad, the U.S. can't keep writing countless checks. We'd do better to push Ukraine toward its most realistic rather than its most ambitious military strategy. The so-called realists forget that Putin has blown past at least a dozen agreements since December, said Julia Ioffe in Puck. Ask Ukraine to cede some territory, and he will eventually gobble more until the state isn't viable. Worse, he has already signaled that the war won't stop in Ukraine. Kremlin-backed TV pundits now call this a war against the collective West. We're already directly involved. The only ones who don't realize it, it seems, are us. The controversy of the week is Depp versus Heard, what the verdict revealed. One of the most common things abusers say to victims is that nobody will believe you, said Charlotte Colombo in the Daily Beast. Sadly, Amber Heard just found that to be true in the most public, humiliating way possible. A Virginia jury ruled last week that the actress had defamed her ex-husband Johnny Depp in a 2018 Washington Post op-ed in which she described herself as a public figure representing domestic abuse. In a televised 7-week trial, Heard gave harrowing testimony that the Pirates of the Caribbean star had headbutted her, strangled her, ripped chunks of her hair out, and sexually assaulted her with a liquor bottle. In a text to a friend that became evidence, Depp said he wanted to kill Heard, adding, I will effing her burnt corpse afterwards to make sure she's dead. Despite damning evidence of Depp's control and humiliation of Heard, the trial descended into an orgy of misogyny. And Maura Donegan in The Guardian, said Maura Donegan in The Guardian, each time she took the stand, a band of Depp-worshipping TikTokers jumped on social media to mock the 36-year-old actress, calling her a lying gold digger and making memes of her crying face. Now a jury has compounded that cruelty by ruling that Heard owes Depp $15 million in damages while awarding her $2 million on her countersuit. The backlash to Me Too has long been underway, but this feels like a tipping point. Heard certainly put on a great show, said Andrea Paeser in the New York Post, but the jury saw through her wild claims, which were littered with contradictions and inconsistencies. Depp, meanwhile, testified that Heard had taunted him, punched him, and thrown a vodka bottle at the star, severing a piece of his finger. Police officers and employees testified that Heard appeared uninjured at times when she claimed to have been battered and bruised. Let's hope this serves as a useful lesson for the Me Too movement, which in recent years got drunk on its own reckless and absolute power, demanding that we should automatically believe all women and destroy men's lives on an accusation. Truth is, life is more complicated than that, said Kaylee McGee White in the Washington Examiner, and this trial demonstrated women can and do lie. This trial has nothing to do with the facts, said A.O. Scott in the New York Times. Depp won because his legal team turned a seemingly clear-cut case of domestic violence into a both-sides melodrama. A British court had already ruled that Depp had physically abused Heard on at least 12 occasions, and Heard provided numerous videos, texts, and photos corroborating her claims. Because she wasn't as charismatic as her lovable rogue ex-husband, and because she wasn't a perfect victim, Heard was deemed unworthy of sympathy. This ruling will have grave consequences for other domestic violence victims, said Jill Filipovich in The Guardian. Abused women have learned that if they try to speak up, they can be financially gouged into silence. In the end, there are no real winners in this case, said Amy Polacco in NBCNews.com. Depp will likely never see the millions in damages Heard now owes him. And while he claimed his career was damaged by her op-ed, this trial exposed the 60-year-old has been a volatile, insanely jealous alcoholic and drug addict. Like Heard, he'd probably never work for a major studio again. Depp may be claiming victory, but it will prove to be a pyrrhic one. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for cortisol levels after new CNN boss Chris Licht informed staff that the network's breaking news banner will be reserved for actual breaking news. CNN has used the banner so routinely, Licht said, that its impact has become lost on the audience. It was a good week for The Inked, with Virgin Atlantic's announcement that it will no longer require cabin staff to cover up their tattoos as part of our focus on inclusion and championing individuality. And it was a good week for mellowing after Johnny Rotten Lydon of the Sex Pistols, 66, said he was really, really proud of Queen Elizabeth II for doing so well as she celebrated 70 years on the British throne. In the Sex Pistols' 1977 hit, God Save the Queen, Rotten sang that the Queen headed a fascist regime and ain't no human being. It was a bad week for catharsis after Brian Hernandez, 21, allegedly broke into the Dallas Museum of Art and destroyed $5 million worth of vases and other artifacts, many from ancient Greece. Hernandez reportedly explained the rampage by saying he was mad at my girl. It was a bad week for frankness after Blake Masters, a Republican U.S. Senate candidate in Arizona, told a conservative podcast that America's gun violence problem can mostly blamed on black people, frankly. It was a bad week for fair fights after Republican Senator John Tooney of South Dakota defended the sale of military-style assault rifles designed to shred human beings because, in my state, they use them to shoot prairie dogs and, you know, other types of varmints. And speaking of assault rifles, the briefing this week is titled, Mass Shooter's Favorite Gun. The assault rifle, America's most popular gun, has become the preferred instrument for mass murder. What defines an assault rifle? Assault rifles, often called AR-15 style weapons, have been used in many mass shootings, including the recent massacre of 10 black people in a Buffalo supermarket and the slaughter of 19 elementary school students and two teachers in Uvalde, Texas. These weapons are identifiable by three features. They're semi-automatic, meaning they can be repeatedly fired with the squeeze of the trigger. They have detachable magazines for easy reloading, and they have components such as a pistol grip that allow shooters to fire continuously with their rifle trained on the target. The AR-15 is the civilian counterpart of the U.S. military's M16, which has a shorter barrel and can fire three-round bursts with one pull of the trigger. These marvels of engineering are stunningly efficient and easy to use, earning the title America's Rifle from the National Rifle Association and the nickname the iPhone of firearms. Why the term AR-15? AR-15 was originally named for the gunmaker Armalite and trademarked by Colt after it bought the manufacturing rights to the weapon. But the patent is long expired, and about 500 gun makers sell similarly designed weapons. There were about 400,000 assault weapons in circulation when a federal ban on them was passed in 1994. But sales exploded when the law expired a decade later. Today, there are about 20 million AR-15s in the U.S. One in five gun purchases is now an assault weapon. How deadly are they? The AR-15 was engineered to cause maximum wound effect, as one of its designers put it. It fires needle-nosed bullets that travel three times faster than handgun rounds and fragment when slamming into flesh, causing enormous damage. Features such as secondhand grips and thumbhole stocks made the weapon easy to aim and hold with both hands while firing dozens of rounds with little recoil. "It's the perfect killing machine," says Dr. Peter Ree, a former Navy trauma surgeon. A study of mass shootings from 2000 to 2017 found that killers who used assault rifles caused 97% more deaths and wounded 81% more victims than those who used handguns. How did assault rifles originate? Adolf Hitler coined the term Sturmgewehr, storm weapon, to describe a new gun with a shorter barrel than the standard Nazi rifle, making it easier to control because it kicked less. The Soviets followed with the AK-47. When American troops encountered Viet Cong troops armed with AKs, they decided to go against conventional military thinking and try the new American-made AR-15, which used unusually light 223 caliber rounds, the same caliber used by the Uvalde shooter. The results were astonishing. The AR-15 mutilated enemy soldiers, leaving many looking as though they had simply exploded, a military report said. What makes them so lethal? Unlike a heavier handgun bullet, which punctures the body like a nail, a high-velocity round from an AR-15 delivers a payload of kinetic energy that radiates outward from the wound, obliterating organs, pulverizing bones, and causing massive bleeding. It can leave a jagged exit wound the diameter of a soda can. When radiologist Heather Scher examined a teenage victim of the 2018 high school shooting in Parkland, Florida, she says she found that one organ looked like an overripe melon smashed by a sledgehammer. The victim could not be saved. After the Uvalde shooting, DNA samples were needed to help identify victims, many of whom were left unrecognizable by horrible wounds. How are these assault rifles marketed? Gun makers call the AR-15 a modern sporting rifle, and its fans insist it just has cosmetic differences from other semi-automatic long guns. But marketing strategies have grown increasingly unsubtle. After the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, commercial AR-15s began appearing in the same desert tan used on the battlefield. Advertisements for Daniel Defense, which sold the weapon used by the Uvalde shooter, show images of U.S. troops with the slogan, "Use what they use." Appeals to masculine insecurity are common, such as a Bushmaster ad for the rifle that said, "Consider your man card reissued." Gunmakers increasingly advertise their weapons as necessary tools, if and when the U.S. descends into anarchy or tyranny. The NRA's magazine advised that a 5-year-old boy could fire an AR if taught the 2-finger trigger pull method. Would restrictions be effective? That's the subject of fierce debate, with gun enthusiasts arguing that restrictions can be circumvented by determined criminals. Still, a 2019 Columbia University study found that banning large-capacity magazines resulted in a 206% drop in the fatality rate of gun massacres. One inescapable irony is that anytime there is renewed discussion of banning assault weapons, it triggers a boom in gun sales. In fact, says Josh Koskoff, an attorney who represented victims' families after the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, gun makers know mass shootings help sell more weapons. They cashed in on that imagery, he said, and muscularity and violence. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with Humanity is Not Doomed. Is it moral to have children in a warming world? Asked Ezra Klein. It's a question I hear constantly, and a growing number of people are deciding that it's not. But nothing in our near future looks so horrible that it turns reproduction into an immoral act. That's not to dismiss the very real suffering that climate change will unleash and that today's children will confront. But there's growing reason to hope humanity will avert apocalypse and limit warming to 2 to 2.7 degrees centigrade rather than the 5 degrees predicted just a decade ago. Costs for solar energy are plummeting, and both government policies and the free market are leading to the rapid development of green energy and innovation. In the zero emissions future, it is possible that no one will have a carbon footprint. To get there, we need the energy and idealism of these young, of the young. For perspective, let's remember that for much of human history, abject poverty was the norm, life was brutish, and nearly half of children died before puberty. Bringing a child into this troubled world has always been an act of hope. I can't say whether it's the right choice for you, but no climate model can either. Hollywood's breakup with China. With great sorrow and reluctance, Hollywood is finally starting to detach its tongue from the Chinese Communist Party's boots, said Kyle Smith. For years, major movie studios have censored any images or themes China's government deems forbidden, so as to have access to the lucrative Chinese audience. But under the increasingly dogmatic rule of Xi Jinping, China's censorious demands have escalated to an absurd degree, even to the point of banning depictions of, quote, sissy men. So Hollywood has come to the sad realization that pursuing Chinese money is not worth the creative and moral cost. The new Top Gun sequel, starring Tom Cruise, will not be released in China. Beijing apparently found the film too jingoistic about the U.S. military. In an early trailer for the film, movie makers scrubbed out a Taiwan patch on Cruise's flight suit, but it's back in the actual movie. In recent years, China has blocked a Spider-Man film because it focused on the Statue of Liberty in its final scenes and a host of Marvel movies over unknown objections. Hollywood should never have kowtowed to an evil empire that oppresses its citizens and tortures its Uyghur Muslim minority. This breakup is long overdue. This column comes from Mexico. The coming civil unrest over water. Mexico's water shortage is becoming a national emergency, said Gibran Ramirez Reyes. It is worst in the border state of Nuevo León, which is in the thick of an extreme drought. The capital city there, Monterrey, has now restricted daily water access to just a six-hour window from 4 a.m. to 10 a.m. But in at least 10 other states, more than 80% of cities are also suffering moderate to severe droughts. There, poorer people are already reusing water in ways that are still unthinkable for the privileged classes. Some of them bathe, do laundry, then do dishes with the same tub full of water. The unfairness of unequal access to this basic need is already causing Mexicans to turn on one another. Last week, an armed group stormed a wine production facility in Nuevo León to seize its water distribution network. It's easy to condemn such violence, but think of how these communities have been neglected for years. Their water looted for use in commercial projects that do not benefit them, yet devastate the ecosystem. Mexico must create a society that treats water, food, and energy as human rights. That may seem utopian now, but it will be simply prudent in the near future when water becomes the main problem of governance in Mexico. And we're on to the last word, our feature article, titled this week, The Testosterone Question. Leah Thomas is in the top ranks of women's swimming and at the center of a rancorous debate about trans athletes in women's sports, said Michael Powell in the New York Times. The women on the Princeton University swim team spoke of collective frustration edging into anger. They had watched Leah Thomas, a transgender woman who swam for the University of Pennsylvania, win meet after meet, beating Olympians and breaking records. On January 9th, the team met with Robin Harris, executive director of the Ivy League Athletic Conference. The swimmers, several of whom described the private meeting on condition of anonymity, detailed the biological advantages possessed by transgender female athletes. To ignore these, they said, was to undermine a half-century fight for female equality in sport. Harris had already declared her support for transgender athletes and denounced transphobia. In an interview, she said she had replied that she would not change rules in mid-season. Somehow, a swimmer recalled, the question of women in sport has become a culture war. The battle over whether to let female transgender athletes compete in women's elite sports has reached an angry pitch, a collision of competing principles. The hard-fought-for right of women to compete in high school, college, and pro sports versus a swelling movement to allow transgender athletes to compete in their chosen gender identities. Although the number of transgender athletes on top teams is small, a precise count is elusive as no major athletic association collects such data, disagreements are profound. They center on science, fairness, and inclusiveness, and cut to the core of distinctions between gender identity and biological sex. The rancor stifles dialogue. At meets, Thomas has been met by stony silence and muffled boos. College female athletes who speak of frustration and competitive disadvantage are labeled by some transgender activists as transphobes and bigots, and are reluctant to talk for fear of being attacked. Thomas has chosen silence. In March, after winning the 500-yard freestyle in the NCAA Women's Championship in Atlanta, she skipped a news conference. Of late, she has spoken only to Sports Illustrated, saying, "I'm not a man, I'm a woman, so I belong on the women's team." Even nomenclature is contentious. Descriptive phrases such as biological woman and biological man might seem as central to discussing differences in performance. Many trans right activists say such expressions are transphobic and insist biology and gender identity are largely social constructs. Some trans activists try to silence critics, whom they derisively called TERFs, T-E-R-Fs, which stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminists. A spokesperson for a gay rights group urged a reporter not to platform, that is, not to quote, those she said held objectionable views, including Martina Navratilova, a retired tennis legend, a champion of liberal and lesbian causes. Navratilova argues that transgender female athletes possess insurmountable biological advantages. So I'm a TERF. Okay, that's the way you want to go? Navratilova said in response. I played against taller women, I played against stronger women, and I beat them all. But if I face the male equivalent of Leah in tennis, that's biology. I would have had no shot, and I would have been livid. Former allies are split so bitterly as to make reconciliation a distant prospect. Half of Thomas University of Pennsylvania team sent a letter to the school, released by a lawyer, saying the swimmer had an unfair advantage. Brooke Ford, an Olympic silver medalist with Stanford, however, supported Thomas. Social change is always a slow and difficult process, and we rarely get it correct right away, she said. Griffin Maxwell Brooks, a transgender non-binary diver at Princeton who competes on the men's team, released a TikTok video accusing cisgender women of leveraging misogyny to perpetuate transphobia. Not long afterward, a Princeton eating club barred a female swimmer from joining, saying her transphobia might bring it into disrepute, according to a Princeton swimmer. Inescapably, America's hyperpartisan politics has electrified this debate. Librarians have been told to remove books with transgender themes from shelves, and Republican-dominated legislatures in 18 states have introduced restrictions on transgender participation in public school sports in recent years, according to data from the Human Rights Campaign, an LGBTQ advocacy group. Michael Joyner, a doctor at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, studies the physiology of male and female athletes. He sees in competitive swimming a petri dish. It is a century old, and the sexes follow similar practice and nutrition regimens. Since prepubescent girls grow faster than boys, they have a competitive advantage early on. Puberty washes away that advantage. You see the divergence immediately as the testosterone surges into the boys, Joyner said. There are dramatic differences in performances. The records for elite adult male swimmers are on average 10 to 12% faster than the records of elite female swimmers, an advantage that has held for decades. Little mystery attends this. Beginning in the womb, men are bathed in testosterone, and puberty accelerates that. Men on average have broader shoulders, bigger hands, longer torsos, and greater lung and heart capacity. Muscles are denser. There are social aspects to sport, but physiology and biology underpin it, Joyner said. Testosterone is the 800-pound gorilla. When a male athlete transitions to female, the NCAA, which governs college sports, requires a year of hormone-suppressing therapy to bring down testosterone levels. The NCAA put this in place to diminish the inherent biological advantage held by those born male. Thomas followed this regimen, but peer-reviewed studies show that even after testosterone suppression, top transgender women retain a substantial edge when racing against top biological women. When Thomas entered women's meets, she rose substantially in the national rankings. Among men, she had ranked 32nd in the 1,650-yard freestyle. Among women, she ranked 8th and won a race this season by a margin of 38 seconds. She had ranked 554th in the men's 200-yard freestyle. She tied for 5th place in this race in the women's 2022 NCAA championship. And she ranked 65th in the men's 500 freestyle, but won the title as a female. Leah Thomas is the manifestation of the scientific evidence, said Dr. Ross Tucker, a sports physiologist who consults on world athletics. The reduction in testosterone did not remove her biological advantage. Testosterone levels are crucial but do not invariably predict performance in every sport. Chris Mosier is a 41-year-old elite athlete who transitioned to male in 2015 and had no testosterone-fueled developmental advantage. Yet he has beaten elite race-walking biological men. Athletic performance depends on a lot of factors. Access to coaches and nutritionists and technical skill, Mosier said. We are making broad generalizations about men being bigger, stronger, faster. Still, most scientists view performance differences between elite male and female athletes as nearly immutable. Israeli physicist Ira Hammerman in 2010 examined 82 events across six sports and found women's world record times were 10% slower than those of men's records. Activists conflate sex and gender in a way that is really confusing, said Dr. Carol Hooven, lecturer and co-director of undergraduate studies in human evolutionary biology at Harvard University. She wrote the book T, The Story of Testosterone. There is a large performance gap between healthy normal populations of males and females, and that is driven by testosterone. Sprinter Allison Felix won the most world championship medals in history. Her lifetime best is the 400 meters was 49.26 seconds. In 2018, 275 high school boys ran faster. Renee Richards was a pioneer among transgender athletes. An ophthalmologist and accomplished amateur tennis player, she played in the U.S. Open and ranked 13th in the men's 35 and over division. She transitioned in 1975 at age 41. She joined the Women's Pro Tennis Tour at age 43, ancient in athletics in athletic terms. Richards then made it to the doubles final at Wimbledon and ranked 19th in the world before retiring at 47. Richards has said she no longer believes it is fair for transgender women to compete at an elite level. I know if I'd had surgery at the age of 22 and then at 24 went on tour, no genetic woman in the world would have been able to come close to me, she said in an interview. I've reconsidered my opinion. To wander the stands in March at the Women's Swim Championships at Georgia Tech and ask about Thomas was to draw shakes of the head from parents and grandparents, sisters and brothers of swimmers. Many emphasize that transgender people should have the same right to housing, jobs, marriage, and happiness as any American. But they talked of the thousands of hours the young women put into their sport. From early childhood, they swam hundreds of laps daily, nursing injuries and watching nutrition. Why, having reached the pinnacle, should they race against a swimmer who retains many biological advantages of a male athlete? We have a biological male taking over women's sports, said one mother. I don't understand why those on the left politically are not supporting cis women. Equality for women in sports followed decades of struggle. 50 years ago, President Richard Nixon signed Title IX, which banned discrimination in higher education. This opened the doors of previously all-male classes and led to many more female teams and scholarships. In 1972, 1 in 27 girls played sports. Today, 2 in 5 do so, according to the Women's Sports Foundation. The 1972 U.S. Olympic team featured 90 female athletes alongside 339 male athletes. Last year's American team in Tokyo had 284 male athletes and a record 329 female athletes. Some transgender activists are challenging aspects of Title IX, specifically its implicit acknowledgement of biological difference. And supporters, not least the Biden administration, say transgender girls should be permitted on girls' sports teams. They have pushed for a federal equality act, which would prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in housing, education, employment, and credit. It potentially places biology and gender identity on the same footing in sport. Dorian Lambelet Coleman, a Duke University law professor and former top track runner, supports legal protections for transgender people but foresees havoc in the arena of sports. The legal rationale for keeping women's sports sex segregated would fall away. "We are bringing a male body into a female sport," Coleman said. "Once you cross that line, there's no more rationale for women's sport." By way of solution, some point to golf, where in amateur competitions, a superior golfer takes a handicap, docking herself strokes when competing against lesser players. Applied to swimming, a panel might examine Thomas' race times and subtract seconds and let her swim. The McDonnell Laurier Institute, a policy organization based in Ottawa, argues for an open category for men, transgender athletes, and biological females, anyone who cares to try his, her, their hand. An exclusively female category would remain for biological women. This solution would forestall the need for transgender women to take hormone-suppressing drugs. Some transgender activists argue such distinctions would be insulting, notwithstanding the decision of those who race in their former gender. The solution, a balance of gender and biology, looks distant, and yet no end of anguish accompanies the status quo. In Atlanta, a father who declined to give his name sat in the stands and watched Thomas in the 200-yard freestyle. She was, he noted, far taller than her competitors, with long legs and arms, big hands, and broad shoulders. A day earlier, his daughter had lost to Thomas in the 500-yard race, and nothing about that race felt fair to him or his daughter. The father was polite as Thomas was announced, and he clapped twice. Thomas lost by a broad margin. She slipped out of the pool, picked up a towel, sidestepped embracing swimmers, and walked out, a solitary figure. The father watched and shook his head. "In fairness to Leah, man, the emotional toll," he said. "I look at her and see the pressure she's under, and I think, she's a 22-year-old kid." A version of the story was originally published in the New York Times. And we'll move on over to the Talking Points page, where we have that article that was referenced on the cover drawing. Biden, can he pull his presidency out of a tailspin? Frustrations are mounting for President Biden, said Jonathan Lemire in Politico. His administration faces a cascade of challenges, with inflation reaching a 40-year high, gas prices soaring to nearly $5 a gallon, the war in Ukraine, a baby formula shortage, a still unpredictable COVID pandemic, and a deadlocked Congress unable to pass meaningful gun legislation in response to an onslaught of mass shootings. Inside the White House, morale is plummeting as the administration struggles to address the many problems that have Americans in a sour mood. Biden has expressed exasperation that his approval rating, which first crossed into negative territory after last August's chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan, remains stuck at 41%, lower than Donald Trump's at this point in his presidency. "The angst has been rippling through the party," said Carol Lee in NBCNews.com, "with congressional Democrats blaming the White House for their dim prospects in November." Biden used to say about President Obama's tenure that everything landed on his desk but locusts, said one White House official. Now he understands how that feels. Whatever happened to the buck stops here, asked Matt Lewis in the Daily Beast. Yes, Biden got dealt some tough cards, but his own choices and lack of leadership and communication skills have made the problem worse. His pullout from Afghanistan was badly botched. He approved trillions in spending while administration officials dismissed the rise of inflation as transitory, and now he is complaining that he can't click a switch to bring food and gas prices down. Americans crave affirmative, optimistic leadership, but Biden's not providing much hope. At an increasingly frail 79, his advancing age is worsening his problems, said Jim Garrity in National Review. He can't speak off script without blurting out something off message. Aides had to make humiliating walkbacks after Biden stated that Vladimir Putin cannot remain in power and that the U.S. would militarily defend Taiwan against China. He's increasingly irritated with his staff for correcting him, yet he won't fire them. Republicans are not wrong in suggesting that the nation's leader is not fully in command of his White House and not up to the job. Still, Biden's camp insists there isn't any ambiguity about his determination to run for re-election in 2024, said Gabrielle DeBenedetti in New York Magazine. But major Democratic donors have quietly started to poke around for alternatives. Vice President Kamala Harris would be the natural choice, but her popularity has tanked even further than Biden's, and their relationship has grown cool and distant. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer are on the list of other possibilities, but the party's bench is not deep, and most Democrats don't want to publicly break with Biden, at least not yet. Every modern president has struggled in his first term, said Jonathan Bernstein in Bloomberg. Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and Barack Obama all saw their approval sink amid crises, only to win re-election. But Biden is discovering the weak relationship between a president's policies and events that can shape public perception of his effectiveness. Voters blame Biden for the country's 8.3% inflation rate, even though Europe has similar inflation. And they do not credit Biden's COVID relief package for rescuing the economy from freefall. Unemployment is currently at 3.6%, near a 50-year low. Americans told pollsters they are willing to pay more for gas to constrain Russia soon after it invaded Ukraine. But when gas prices rose as Russian oil was banned, they blamed Biden anyway. The economy is actually quite strong, said Andrew Egger and Esther Eaton in the Dispatch. Another solid jobs report in May revealed 390,000 new hirings, with wages still rising and millions of available jobs. Plus, inflation seems to have peaked, at least for now. Yet none of that has punctured the gloomy outlook shared by voters and the markets. Biden could point to a host of major achievements: vaccinating two-thirds of Americans against COVID, passing an infrastructure bill, uniting NATO behind Ukraine, and reviving the economy, said Michael Tomosky in The New Republic. But his messaging has been defensive and unimaginative. Democrats are at a disadvantage in winning over popular opinion because only 25% of Americans identify as liberal. That means Democrats have to do a lot more reaching beyond their base than conservatives do, and they often get tied up in complex policy wonkery that seems detached from ordinary Americans' problems. If anyone can reverse this impression, it's in Biden, an old-school Truman-type Democrat who is more unambiguously on the side of working people than any Democratic president in a very long time. But he looks tired, and he'd better get a second win soon. And just enough time left for a few short notes. About 100 Americans die on average every day from gun violence. Currently, 60 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers are dying daily in the war, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky recently estimated. In the first 8 months of 2021, the NRA spent just $13,900 on School Shield, the program it launched to promote school safety after the 2012 mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. Last year, the gun rights group had revenues of $282 million. More than 82 million COVID vaccines, over 11% of the total distributed throughout the U.S., were discarded between December 2020 through mid-May 2022, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Last February, the CDC reported that 65 million doses were thrown away. The doses are being discarded mostly because of lack of demand, inefficiencies, and expirations. On the poll watch, 72% of Americans say that mass shootings could be prevented if we really tried. But 44% of Republicans say we have to accept them as part of free society. 72% of Democrats say banning assault weapons would do a lot. 60% of Republicans say the answer is better mental health screenings. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from comedian George Carlin, who says, "Tell people there's an invisible man in the sky who created the universe, and the vast majority will believe you. Tell them the paint is wet, and they have to touch it to be sure." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.